everyone. I'm Kale Mary.
And I'm Soda.
And we are Space Trio Podcast, returning for another episode. Today, we're reviewing the third and fourth episodes of the animated series, Season 1. The episodes are One of Our Planets is Missing and The Lorelei Signal.
Yeah. Well, can I just start by saying that One of Our Planets is Missing, the title doesn't really have anything to do with the story itself.
No, it doesn't. That's a very good point. The other titles, I suppose, from the first and second episode sort of match what they're about. I think the Lorelei Signal matches as well. But I don't know what One of Our Planets is Missing really references. And once we get into talking about the actual plot of the episode, I don't think the listeners will either.
Yeah.
Before we get into the episode, I just want to say this is written by Mark Daniels. Mm-hmm. I couldn't determine if he had written any other original series episodes. So let's just say I don't know that he's an original series writer. So he may be a new writer come to the animated series to do this episode. However, I do know that once again, Alan Dean Forrester wrote a novelette based off of this episode in the same way that he did for Beyond the Farthest Star, the pilot episode of the series.
Mm-hmm.
So this episode kicks us off with the Enterprise on a critical mission. They are going towards the end of their... it's kind of interesting. One of their further systems, because their colony, Mantelis, is in danger of this very strange unknown space cloud, which has entered their galaxy and seems to be headed towards Mantelis. And what's interesting about Mantelis is the governor of Mantelis is Robert Wesley. And Robert Wesley is retired from Starfleet. We first met him in the Ultimate Computer episode. He was Commodore Robert Wesley. He was playing part of the war games against the M115 created by Dr. Daystrom. So here they just call him Bob Wesley.
Yeah. I totally didn't... You know, I didn't think about it. I just didn't recognize that he was already on the original series. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so he's in a way a returning character, but only in the fact that he is the governor of this colony. And the colony is not small. It's about 82 million people. So there is obviously some concern that this unknown space cloud, very high energy. In fact, I think when Spock does his analysis of it, he says it's made of antimatter, is a potential threat to the colony. And so the Enterprise, of course, being the ship closest in that sector of space, rushes out there to see what's going on, and they encounter this giant pink red cloud. And they have discovered that it has just consumed another body, space body.
I think it was another planet.
But it was close to Mantelis, but it apparently was not inhabited, and it just sort of went over it and ate it up. They're very concerned because, of course, the space cloud turns its heading to Mantelis and is within a few hours of reaching the colony. So immediately Kirk makes the decision to contact Bob Wesley. There is some concern that they'll create, of course, panic on the colonists, because there's not going to be time to evacuate the entire colony before the deadly space cloud arrives. Yet he makes the decision to call it Bob Wesley. Bob says, well, he sort of got like an oh shit moment. But So they have been notified, and then of course, Kirk decides to get closer to the space cloud entity to see, you know, what is it they can do to push this cloud off course or to somehow prevent it from reaching Mantles and consuming the entire planet. In the course of that, they get sucked into the cloud. And I think here's where it gets a little interesting because we start these references of the cloud being more like an entity or a living being because they reference the Enterprise being sucked in as being like consumed by the cloud. And then you start to have McCoy comes onto the bridge and through the course of trying to figure out like what it is that's happening to them inside this entity, it looks like they're being digested. So
They even go through like a digestive tract. Like it looks like the inside of an animal, basically.
yeah, so what they originally thought, you know, might just be like a I would say almost kind of like the single-celled organism. Do you remember the space amoeba from the immunity syndrome?
Yeah, I immediately remember that when I watched this episode.
But it seems to be a lot more than that because the further they go along this digestive track, and they have somehow mapped the body of the space cloud, and they see that there's a way to possibly get out of it, but they actually have to move through it to get out of it. And of course, it's not easy because this thing is made of antimatter, so if they, in any shape or form, touch like the sides of the cloud or these like filaments that McCoy says are very much like the biological function to absorb nutrients when you're digesting food in your intestinal tract, if they touch it, it will blow up the ship. So, and they're rapidly losing power inside the space cloud as they try to navigate it. The first thing they do on their way to find a way out of this is they try attacking it. But of course, it really drains the ship's resources, and the last thing they want to do is to lose the engines and be stuck drifting and then ultimately end up digested by the space cloud or self-destructing or something. And so they are also, of course, on a time crunch because the space cloud, even though they're inside it, it's still moving toward Mantles. Their next idea is that they determine that it has something like a brain. And one of their possibilities here is that they can destroy the ship and in the same instance take out the brain of the organism that they're inside and essentially kill it but also stop it from reaching Mantles. So of course Jim has a moment where he's, you know, asking himself the question, you know, is it the right thing to do to kill a living organism? And then of course, you know, Bones tells him, well, what else can you do in this situation? Even if we self-destruct the ship and we kill this organism, I mean, we will save 82 million lives. They start a countdown, and of course, Spock comes up with another alternative. And that is to mind meld with the entity of which they are inside and see if he can eventually, you know, he has enough time to convince it to not eat Mantles. And then, you know, just to fast track a little bit, he does it. He's able to successfully connect with the being. The being is like, who are you? What are you? And he's like, we're inside. I'm inside of you. We're smaller beings inside of you. And eventually he convinces the space cloud that to mind meld with him in such a way that the space cloud can actually like see through his eyes and see their ship and the people on the ship and to see like pictures of the colony to which the entity is about to consume. And he convinces it to leave the galaxy. And it's all based off the premise that the entity itself cannot recognize, being so large, cannot recognize that there are tiny living beings on the food or, quote, the planets that it is consuming. But the being itself does not have a desire to kill.
Yeah.
To kill its food, basically. Spock convinces it to turn back the way it came and to leave the galaxy. And they do it just in time to save the colony. And cue the
last minute.
cue the happy end music.
Yeah. As far as episodes go, I'd say it was probably the weakest one so far. Even more than the first episode. I felt like we've seen this before.
We have. A Taste of Armageddon is very close to it.
I immediately thought about the giant amoeba episode.
And right, and the space amoeba episode is very close to it. I think they tried to take it to another level because this space cloud is supposed to actually have a brain and not just be like a giant mitochondria.
Yeah. But they do. They actually compare it to an amoeba in this episode,
yeah.
The cloud. Yeah. So yeah, the animation inside the cloud was kind of pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It almost looked like traveling through a human body. But aside from that, it was really just a very standard episode.
It is a very standard episode, I think. Probably the one thing I find interesting about it is that it made me think about the things that we as humans eat, because we do in fact consume food that has a lot of, let's say, microorganisms. You know, bacteria is part of like the fermentation process, which is part of one of the ways we consume food. Like we eat a lot of fermented food. So it made me think about the sort of ecological system that probably exists at the microbiological level, and that we as humans, being so much bigger than something that we can't see with the naked eye, in a sense, we're just like the space cloud. Like we don't have the ability to know enough about the things that live at like the level which we are not aware. And so when the ship was inside this quote digestive tract of the space amoeba, it made me think, wow, this is just like when we have microorganisms or like bacteria in our digestive system. And what kind of ecological system, like what kind of living organisms are they that we just naturally eat them and don't ever think about the fact that we kill them? So
yeah, but I think the giant cloud wasn't presented as like evil. It wasn't evil. He just didn't know. Unlike the creature in the first episode.
That's what I'm saying. Like when you exist at a different level, and you don't have the ability to sense things that are far below you or that exist on an entirely lower level, I will say just a different scale, right? You don't know what you don't know. So the space cloud was very confused to be contacted mentally. It seems like it had strayed quite a long ways from its natural territory and was alone. And suddenly to have a tiny little voice in its brain that said it was inside it, I'm sure was very confusing.
Must have been, yeah.
And can we just say, can I just pause for a minute and say, Spock's touch telepathy here is not necessary. He actually goes, I normally need to touch something to mind meld with it, but I think I can do it just based off of telepathy. And so he
they do something, they amplify it somehow with the ship something, I don't
sensors,
know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's so weird.
it's a little bit of a stretch for me that I'm not quite sure how that works. So
I mean,
we have seen him like influence somebody through a rock wall.
Yeah, exactly.
So I love it. He like throws out his hands, and closes his eyes, and obviously he's like putting his powers of telepathy through the ship sensors. and
Exactly.
connects with this being. And then somehow invites the being to come in to merge minds and to like come into his brain at a much smaller level. I'm not sure how the science of this works. And yeah.
Yeah, Spock's telepathy to the rescue once again.
Also, I was very tickled by his comment that the
Yeah.
space cloud seems like a bull grazing in a pasture.
Two more things I wanted to say about this episode is
Yeah.
that one, we got a good look at the engine this episode, and I also really like that design. I mean, the original, the animation stuff, the movement of the characters is not good, but the backgrounds and stuff are beautiful.
Yeah, you can tell that they definitely spend, the animators spend a lot more time on designing the background and the sets for the show.
Yeah. And the second thing is that I think this is like the most we've heard out of what's his name? Erex. Erex.
It is. Yeah, you're
Yeah.
right. It's the first time Kirk calls him Lieutenant Erex.
Yeah, Erex, yeah. And he gets a speaking role this episode. He's the new helmsman that's replacing Chekhov. And yeah, it's the first time we hear him.
I will say there's some classic like Star Trek philosophy here, especially when you have Kirk asking the question, "Do I have the right to kill?"
Yeah.
in order to save, many more people. I think that question comes up quite a lot in just Star Trek itself.
Yeah. I think that, well, like I said, the one that popped into my head immediately is the giant amoeba episode. I don't remember if the ship was in danger, but he did also have to make like this hard decision between sending Spock or McCoy. I think, it might have even been a harder decision because in here he's like, his choice would include going down with his ship. Here he's just sending one man to die alone.
Yeah.
But what I want to say that another thing that is very Star Trekky about this episode is that like the confidence that they ask the amoeba, the cloud thing, not to kill, and it's like, yeah, I don't want to kill. It is very Star Trekky. Like to assume that the basic nature of every creature is like peaceful.
Yeah. I actually felt bad for the governor. Because, he gets this last minute call, hey, your planet's about to be eaten. Maybe you want to start evacuation measures. And then somehow, I think somehow they actually like can talk to the governor while they're in the space cloud. And he says that they've decided to save the children, but it's only 5,000. I don't know.
Yeah.
And it kind of reminded me of the Tarsus 4 situation in Governor Kodos, because I had a moment there where Kirk was asking Governor Wesley, "What are you going like? How are you going to decide who lives?" And then of course Wesley's quick to respond, "We'll save the children." I had in my mind a flashback to that situation with Governor Kodos and deciding who lives and who dies.
Yeah, honestly, I kind of wonder if the writers thought about it because it did seem like a very interesting point for Kirk to make.
Yeah.
I think the implication was that not only they don't only have 5,000 children, just that they don't have enough ships for everyone. They only have enough ships for 5,000 people, and they send children.
Yeah. I would say somebody needs to enact a preparedness plan. In the event there is like a pandemic.
Yeah.
And so you are prepared to have enough ships to at least save half of the people.
Yeah.
Like, I only make that comment because it kind of strikes home a little bit right now.
Yeah.
So shall we move on?
Yes. Episode 4, the lower lacing. All right, so the Enterprise finds itself in a spot where apparently both all the Romulans, Klingons, and Federation have gotten together and realized that in this very spot, every 27 years, a ship disappears. But the Enterprise is for some reason sent alone to the spot. And they get a weird signal coming from a pretty distant planet. And the signal sounds more like music. Now, Uhura says sound is kind of musical, but not very interesting. But for some reason, all the men on the ship are very interested in the signal. When they reach the planet, Kirk takes a team of only men with him, and they beam down to the planet and meet a group of beautiful women who lure them to their side with music and food and I don't know what else, basically music and food. And you can see throughout this entire process that the men of the Enterprise are becoming very weird, kind of
Infatuated.
saturated, lethargic, kind of mellow. As it turns out, the women kind of sap their powers and put a sort of headband on them that even drains them of their life force and makes them age 10 years every day, though they seem to age a lot more than 10 years every day, I gotta say.
I have to because at one point McCoy goes, "Well, we've only got 4 days left." I was like, "Dang."
Yeah, I mean, he ended up in the live action series, he ended up living to the age of 130, something like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's more than 4 days, McCoy, I'm sorry. Meanwhile, on the ship, Uhura and Chapel basically take command of the Enterprise. They realize something is very wrong here, but it only affects the men. They beam down to the planet and discover that the women on the planet are basically descendants of a species that came from outside of the planet. When the species came to the planet, they discovered that it had very detrimental effects on the men, but it gave the women power. It gave the women the ability to survive by making them immortal, by sapping the power of the men, I guess. I didn't really understand how that goes. But in exchange for that immortality, they become basically stuck on the planet with no ability to even breathe.
Or
They're kind of
learn, or love.
older, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds very sad.
Yeah. Basically, they have a very sad life and they want to get out, but don't know how for some reason. I have no idea. How did they come there if they don't know how to get out of there? And of course, Uhura frees the men and gives the women help so they can leave their prison planet or whatever. It was kind of a fun episode. Kind of dumb, but kind of fun episode. I pretty much like it. It's the first episode we get to see Uhura as captain, acting captain, as she has to take charge because all of the men are kind of loopy.
Yep. And the men are basically helpless this entire episode.
There are a few moments in this episode that are just so funny because they come out of nowhere. Like,
I know what you're going to say.
the point where it's like the men just discovered they are trapped on the planet and they are sapping their powers, and oh no, and suddenly it cuts to the Enterprise just floating in space. Well, Scotty
Slowly.
sings slowly. Well, Scotty sings some Scottish song, and Uhura and Chapel just standing there staring at him like, what is
Actually, I was thinking, like, what is going on? Why are we having this like slow motion Enterprise to somebody singing? Like, what is the point of this? And then we realize, of course, that it's Scotty who's acting captain, and he's just kind of yeah. He basically Uhura's like, get off the captain's chair. I'm in command now. You're useless. So, interesting about this is really only the third time we've seen a woman commanding a ship from, so there was twice in the original series, like I think number one was in command in the cage. And then you had Dr. Janice Lester in Kirk's body in command in the Turnabout or in Turnabout Intruder. So, but this is the first time a actual female like bridge crew member of Kirk's crew is in command of the Enterprise that we see.
Also, it kind of made me wonder if for so many years, apparently, ships have been disappearing in this area. What does it mean exactly that there were no women on the ship, on these ships, that there weren't enough women to save the men? What happened?
Exactly. And here's what I don't understand. If when they went to the planet, this race came to this planet from elsewhere, and it only affected the men that made them like age and, you know, essentially rapidly age and die, and gave them this special gland, I think that's what she called it, the leader, that allowed them, basically allowed them to suck the life force and convert it to a way to make them immortal. Maybe that I was like, wasn't that just like a development of your species? I mean, what if somebody else comes to the planet? Like, why is it just the men, like just the males, and you know, not like the females too from other races? What? I don't understand.
Yeah, it
And
was
then, like you
very
said,
unclear.
it, are all the ships, Klingons and Romulans, are included in here, by the way. They have all said that they've had ships disappear in this sector of space. Like, are they all just manned by men? Is this, how is it the Enterprise is really the first ship with, you know, female crew able to save the day? Like, I'm with you. I don't understand.
I kind of like that they played on the, you know, the basically it played on the myth of the siren. You know, it's a very old
They did.
sea really. It's very common in
It's basically a signal that in the male brain causes them to hallucinate. I think Spock says, "Wow, I think I hear the Vulcan marriage drum." And then McCoy's like talking about like magnolias. But you know, Spock is cognizant enough to say, I believe I was experiencing audio visual like stimulation. Like he's like, I'm hallucinating.
I mean, at first they're all kind of, you know, kind of aware that something is weird is going on, but then there's like the closer they get and the more they're exposed to it, the more they're like they don't care basically. So just become kind of drunk and loopy and
I mean, really, Kirk is the one who
fine.
decides that they should hide in a giant urn in the garden. At which point they almost drown when it starts to rain. Like, what? We should mention that this is the first time we see Chapel. And she gets made chief medical officer in McCoy's stead.
Yeah, because of course there are also no ship doc no female doctors on the Enterprise.
Yep, and this is another episode where Spock uses some mind melding, except this time he uses his mind to reach out to Chapel, and he even calls her Christine. I noted that.
Did you do it with mind melding? I thought you just used the communication system.
No, it's through his mind. He doesn't actually like move his mouth.
Oh, interesting.
It's because I mean he does try and tell them like he tries to give them some orders, right? And to be honest, they're already like 10 steps ahead of him in trying to figure out how to save them. But yeah, I could swear he does like because they're trying to find him, remember? They don't know where he is. And so he uses his telepathy to help them find where he is. Directly to Chapel.
Yes.
How does Spock like reenact that same noise
Oh,
that the female leader does to use the spyglass or whatever it is.
that is what I'm going to say, because we see again this. It's very 60s, you know, it's very 60s futuristic, kind of this kind of computer they have that is only activated by voice, and not even by voice, but like a very specific tone of singing.
Like a siren.
Exactly. But it's very, you know, 60s futuristic, you know, retro futuristic.
And Spock is able to replicate it exactly.
Yeah.
Even when he's like rapidly aging and weak. I was astonished. He heard it once and he was good to go. Like maybe he must be very musically inclined. I mean, hey.
I mean, he does play.
Yeah.
Oh,
Oh, it did remind me a lot of the Deadly Years
because
with the rapid aging.
the age. Yeah. I thought like the concept of the siren is kind of relevant beyond the Deadly Years. I don't really like the Deadly Years. It's like it's okay episode, but I'm not a big fan of it. I do like the Lorelei signal better, even if it does, you know, some stupid noise.
Oh, right. Let's talk for a second about the science of how they reverse the aging.
Oh yeah. That was so like quick at the end of the episode. I completely forgot about it. They just kind of used some of the transporter patterns to just bring them back to the state they were before they beamed down.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be honest, like Spock goes, well, this probably won't work. It's like 99.7 to 1 or something chance that it won't work. And they're like, well, we've got no other alternatives. So,
Yeah.
but it made me think, if that's a way for you to reverse aging, then why aren't we doing this in the future? Like, why are you guys not just like recording people's patterns at a young age, and then when they reach 130, you just beam them back at a pattern of when they were younger?
I have no idea.
I just thought that was sort of like a throwaway solution to the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea why they put it in the first place because it really makes no sense. I guess they kind of maybe they had to fill like a few minutes and they're like, okay, let's
Well,
put this in there.
how do we undo this part since they didn't have a better, smarter way? They just
Yeah.
really made it up on the fly, I think.
Yeah.
The only other thing I want to mention here is that the writer of this episode is Margaret Armin, and she's actually is a original series writer. She did The Gamesters of Triskelion and The Paradise Syndrome and The Cloud Minders.
I like the Cloud Miners. I know not a lot of people do, but I do. The Paradise Syndrome is just it's the worst episode of the So I guess she's a hit and miss, but when she hits, and when she misses, she misses.
So would we put this one? I think this was considered one of the better episodes of the animated series.
Yeah, it is. Again, the background, especially of the planet of the sirens, is very, very beautiful.
Although they are very carbon copies of each other. They're all like white-haired and
I
blue-eyed
didn't
with
hear that.
yellow gowns.
Yeah, character design is not this show's strongest suit. Yeah. I mean, all the men are also like generic white brown-haired guys too, and all the women are generic white brown-haired women in red dresses. The design of the planet was beautiful, and it was nice to see, you know, Chapel and Uhura get an episode where they are the stars. And yeah, that was kind of fun.
Yeah, I think the planet was very much designed like Roman god type
Yeah.
atmospheres. You know, you have the huge urns and the classic architecture and everybody in like slinky gowns. I don't know. It was very lovely. I guess it would have been like quote a paradise, but not if you're gonna die in like 5 days.
Yeah.
It did remind me also of Mud's Women, because
Yeah.
the quote sirens are that live on this planet, I mean, they almost sort of alluded to them like with this gland, like being able to, what is it I'm trying to say, exude this like pheromone or whatever it is that seduces the men. So it's not just like the signal. It was very strange. Like they weren't clear whether it was only the signal or also whatever it is this women have developed to keep the men's attention, much in the way that Mud was, you know, spraying something on the women that he was trying to get married
Yeah.
for a price.
And I'm also interested because they said that they're like ancestors, but then they said they can't get pregnant. So, well, wouldn't it just be them? Why do they call them ancestors?
I don't know. I think that's also strange. They're either the children, but if the women gained immortality, like, don't know. It's very odd.
Yes, it
It's also a little Amazonian, right? Like
I
the
mean,
women of the Amazon, you know, it's just women in the society and they only lure men to like possibly breed, and but no men live with them. The difference being that these women didn't want to be by themselves.
yeah, that's exactly it. It wasn't by choice, so
Yeah, you would have thought that instead of just luring their prey and sucking the life force out of them, you know, if they had to do this every 27 years, they would have negotiated getting off their planet.
exactly. Why didn't they think of that?
I don't know. Maybe the Romulans and the Klingons weren't amendable. Well, I think that wraps it up for this episode, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Again, two episodes. I think like last time, one was better than the other.
Yep, I agree. Well, that's all we have to say about these two episodes. Thank you, everyone, for listening today, and we'll be back with another podcast soon. Bye.
Goodbye.